This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street, or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today. Greetings, I am Barry. This is The Voice Within for another week. A slightly different show this week. We have just one presenter. Now, a few weeks ago, Lynn McGregor was interviewed by Inspire Nation. And draw your own conclusions whether what she did at that time has eventuated or not.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Michael Sandler, your host on Inspire Nation. If you've ever felt we needed greater peace or an end to the wars right now, then do we have the Peace Experiment show for you? Today, I'll be talking with Lynn McTaggart, the amazing investigative journalist, best-selling author, and the creator of The Power of Eight. That's just what I want to talk with her about today, about how we can use The Power of Eight and group meditation and intention to stop the violence and the war and help humanity round this dangerous critical bend. Plus, a group intention Power of Eight meditation at the end. So welcome back to the show, Lynn. Are you ready to shine?
Thank you so much, Michael. It's great to be here with you again.
It is so good to have you here. A mighty woohoo! And can't believe I'm going to switch from the woohoo. But can we use, before we dive right into things, can we use group intention and group meditation to stop war?
Well, I've done about 10 peace intention experiments, and we've seen some amazing results. The very first one we did in 2008 was about stopping a war in Sri Lanka, which had been going on for 25 years. And it was an intractable war. Neither side were winning. So I did an intention 10 minutes a day with my audience for 8 days. And afterward, we discovered, and by we, I mean me and the professor of statistics, Dr. Jessica Utz, who was studying the outcome with me. She's from the University of California. And we found that violence quadrupled during the week of our intention. I was terrified about this. But then it plummeted. And also we found out why. The government won a few decisive battles in that week, that very week that turned around the entire course of the war. Within a few months, they had regained the ground that had been choked off, the whole north, choked off by the rebel forces. And a few months after that, that 25-year war was over. Now, did we do this? Who knows? But every intention we've done, we did one to lower violence in the most violent place in America, which was St. Louis, Missouri, and the violence lowered in just that area that we focused on, that neighborhood, by 43% compared to the rest of St. Louis, where violence continued to go up. We did it for two provinces in southern Afghanistan in the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And those two areas experienced the greatest lowering of violence. And this was the stronghold of the Taliban at the height of the war with America.
Yeah.
Greatest lowering of violence, according to NATO statistics, provided to me by a German general, the head of the combined forces. It showed that compared to everywhere else, that area experienced the greatest lowering of violence. So we keep seeing it over and over and over again. We can't say for sure with a war, but it starts looking pretty compelling.
Wow, wow, wow. How did you end up getting into this or tripping across this?
I tripped across it. Thank you for that. I am an investigative reporter by training, as you mentioned. I started out my career trying to put bad guys in jail. You know, I started out my career trying to bust a baby selling ring, which I did, which was the subject of my first book. You know, and it was hidden tape recorders and all of that investigative type stuff. And I segued into covering things about health and conventional medicine in particular and the dangers of it. So I started investigating that with my husband, Brian Hubbard, who's also a journalist, when we started our newsletter, What Doctors Don't Tell You, now 33 years ago. And in the course of doing that, I kept coming across very good studies of things like spiritual healing, acupuncture, homeopathy. And I kept wondering to myself, particularly about spiritual healing, if we can have a thought and send it to someone else and make them better, that in itself undermines everything we think about how the world works. And so I set out trying to find out whether there was such a thing as human energy fields. And what I discovered was not a simple answer, but a bunch of scientists working in consciousness research who had each discovered a small patch of land that was essentially a new version of the world, something that compounded when all put together into a completely new science, a completely new view of the world. But scientists like to stay in their own comfortable little patch. Yes. Everybody had discovered a bucket of earth, as I like to say, but nobody wanted to declare it a continent. So that job got left to me. And in the course of that, it really changed me. And I started wondering more about the whole idea of thoughts and how thoughts are things that can affect other things. And that led me to more and more and wanting to test it with the intention experiments and then wanting to shrink it down to see what would happen if I just put people in a small group of eight.
What was the thinking? And thank you so much for sharing. What was the thinking behind it? If prayer from one helps, let's put a group together and see what that looks like. And then understanding that you didn't need maybe a massive critical mass to make a difference.
I started learning it bit by bit with the intention experiments. And the idea for the intention experiments had a bit to do with transcendental meditation. Yeah. That organization had done a lot of studies showing that if you have a critical mass of meditators in a particular area, the crime rate will go down. And that started me thinking, with meditation, it is a passive act. You know, you are just trying to get to no mind. So I wondered, well, if thoughts are things that affect other things, and there are lots of studies that I was coming across with these scientists to show that is the case, I wondered how far we could take this. Number one, you know, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about big things like ending wars or curing cancer or just little things? And secondly, what would happen if lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? Does that magnify the effect? So it was pure curiosity that had me write my next book called The Intention Experiment after that first book in this area called The Field. And The Intention Experiment was also this invitation to take part in these experiments. And what I started doing in 2007 was every so often I would ask one of the scientists I knew working at prestigious universities like Princeton, Penn State, University of Arizona, University of California, and elsewhere to set up an experiment or to monitor an experiment and measure it afterward. I would, meanwhile, invite my readers around the world, and there were lots of them by then. My book, The Field, was in 30 languages. Or I would ask an audience, if I were speaking in front of a group, to take part in this experiment. So We've run 40 of them to date, Michael, 36 of which have shown measurable, positive, mostly significant effects. We've done everything from trying to make seeds grow faster to purifying water, to lowering violence, as I mentioned, to healing people of things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And of those 40, 36 have shown measurable, positive, mostly significant effects.
You're on a roll, so I don't want to interrupt you, but which one is your baby?
They're all my babies. I don't have a favorite, but I guess my favorites are, number one, early on, the seed experiment, because that taught us a lot and it answers a question you just asked me before. With that experiment, I was working with Dr. Gary Schwartz of the University of Arizona, noted psychologist. He set up an experiment with his laboratory where he put together four sets of seeds, of 30 seeds each, labeled them A, B, C, D, sent me the photos of them. I was in Sydney, Australia, doing a talk at the time, and I decided to do this experiment with my audience of 700. So we chose the seeds. Let's say we chose seeds A. We didn't tell the scientists which ones, but we did the experiment and then just told the scientists, we're done. That was the cue to plant the seeds. They planted them. 5 days later, they measured them, and it was only after they measured them that I unblinded the study and told them, oh, it was seeds A. Lo and behold, it was seeds A that grew significantly higher than controls. And we did this five more times with different size audiences, one of which was an audience over the internet. So thousands of people around the globe, only 100 in a small experiment in Rhinebeck, New York, and so forth. Audiences of different sizes in South Carolina, Dallas, Los Angeles, and over the internet. And every single time we got the same outcome. So that taught me, as each experiment has taught me, something new, that size of audience doesn't matter. All you need is a group of any size. And of course, I love that experiment because I was 8,000 miles away from the target. So was my audience. You know, target's in Tucson, Arizona. I'm in Sydney, Australia with the audience. And also, I'm just sending intention with the audience to a photo of the target, not even the target itself, a symbol of the target. So that also taught me about the psychic internet that we create with group intention. So that's one of my favorites. I guess my biggest favorites, though, Michael, are the ones we've done more recently where we've been experimenting with polarized communities.
Ooh,
we started
so
this in, well, exactly. Well, we started this in, it was 2011, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I decided to do something other than watch those buildings collapse, as we have done every single anniversary since it happened. I said, we need another narrative here. So I have spoken around the world, and one of the places I've spoken at is the Middle East. And I've been hosted by a guy called Dr. Salah al-Rashid, who is like the Deepak Chopra of the Middle East. He's got a huge following. He's a big peace advocate. And I asked him if he and his audience would like to take part. So he invited Arabs from all over the Gulf states, yes, thousands of them. I invited my Western audience, particularly Americans. So we had Americans and Arabs,
yes,
doing an intention to lower violence in those two southern provinces of Afghanistan I talked about before, the stronghold of the Taliban. And so, as I mentioned, we got data months later from NATO showing a big lowering of violence in just those two provinces compared to the rest of the country. Interesting. but not as interesting as, to my mind, as what was going on in my Facebook page and instant messenger page. I saw the Arabs start sending love to the Americans, the Americans forgiving the Arabs saying, your God is my God. You are brothers from the other side. And this big love fest happening. And we've carried on with that. 2007, the end of 2007, I did a similar type of experiment, but this time it was to lower violence in Jerusalem, and I had Arabs and Israelis there. Woo-hoo. And we had audiences from 8 different Arab countries and special equipment where I could talk to each place, they could talk to me, and also the Israeli audience could talk as well. So everybody could talk to each other and I could talk to the whole lot. So we did this intention to lower violence in Jerusalem, which was experiencing violence there at the time. But again, the outcome wasn't as interesting as what was going on between the Arabs and the Israelis. Now, I had to broker this whole arrangement because neither side, even the heads of both sides, would speak to each other. They were hated enemies. By the end of it, it was again a love fest. Your God is my God. We love you, sister, from the other side. We love you so much. People were crying. It was amazing. The whole thing went viral. And then for the inauguration of Joe Biden, I had a special webinar broadcast plus a broadcast out there. And we had on there hated enemies. We had Republicans and Democrats. We had the police and some African Americans. And we had all kinds of things like that. I was just trying to bring together polarized people. And once again, Love Fest. So we're planning a very big one next summer with Gaia, where we are going to do a big one with Republicans and Democrats, because in the summer before the election, we're probably going to need it more than ever.
Causality is one thing. Understanding the mechanism is even harder. But what is your guess as the mechanism? And obviously, this has to do with the field. This has to do with non-locality. Heck, you were shooting love at seeds, at a photo of seeds, and it made a difference. What do you think is the mechanism going on here?
Well, there are two mechanisms I'd like to talk about. One is the mechanism of the intentions. And then the mechanism of how people can turn, do an intention together who are hated enemies and have a love fest. So thank you for asking. On the mechanism of causality for how come these things work,
yeah,
we have to go back to the whole idea that we are not solid and stable things. We think we are, but we are essentially, as somebody once put it, rhythms and empty space.
Beautiful.
We are energy at the lowest level of our being, the nethermost level of our being. We are energy, trading energy back and forth like an endless game of tennis. So we are energy, and so are the things we're focusing on. They're all energy. And in trading energy, we know at the subatomic level, there is non-locality. We know, scientists know that, but they have always tried to separate the law of the tiny from the law of the large. So they say, as though this makes perfect sense, that subatomic particles behave according to the weird world of quantum physics. You know, they have non-locality. Once they come into contact, two subatomic particles are forever influenced by each other, no matter how far you separate them. You can put one on Earth and the other one on Mars, and they'll still know and be affected by each other. And you also have the thing with subatomic particles that they're not an anything yet. They're only a potential of something. They're actually all possible selves at the same time, unless observed or measured. in which case they collapse from being a potential of something or all possible selves into something real. They collapse down to a single state. Those two properties are so essential for understanding intention, because what we're saying is the universe is malleable, it's influenceable, and it needs our involvement, engagement as observers and also influencers to collapse down to something real. We also know from the evidence now that it's not just the world of the tiny that operates according to quantum rules. We also know that big visible things now do as well. For instance, photosynthesis, one of the most essential activities in plants that is responsible for all life on Earth, the ability of plants to take light from the sun, convert it into oxygen, and then breathe life into the universe, that happens according to a quantum process. Right in the crucible of the plant, where that's happening, there is essentially superposition. Electrons operate by going in several directions at once in order to get to the most efficient path to make this all happen. That's been measured at the University of California at Berkeley. We also know now that the biggest molecules in the universe, they are called buckyballs. They're some of the biggest ones, and called that because they look, it's a Buckminster Fullerene. Yes. And it's named after Buckminster Fuller because these molecules, when designed, look a bit like a geodesic dome.
I was just at Epcot this weekend. a giant buckyball.
A giant buckyball. So we now know that these are also in a state of superposition. Biggest molecules in the universe still aren't in anything yet. So we have that. We have non-locality works at the world at large. We've seen an example of it. Our seeds. I'm in Sydney, Australia. The seeds are in Tucson, Arizona. We're not looking at the seeds. We're looking at a photo of the seeds. That is enough. So the materialistic sticks and stones world that we've been taught, that people say is the way the world works, is out of date, is incomplete. We have to bring in quantum effects and understand they're part of the world at large. The other thing we have to bring in to our consciousness and understand is that we have the gift. We are all born with the gift of being able to influence our world, being able to heal ourselves, each other, and the world. But this gets denied to us. We probably know it as children. We undoubtedly know it as children. But our authority figures, our parents, our teachers, etc., you know, make us disbelieve this. We lose confidence in this ability, and then we stop. We don't believe it. We don't use it. It atrophies. So we have to really relearn that we have this capacity. And I've seen it. I've seen thousands of people get healed through the power of intention. I've seen two people get up out of their wheelchairs, one paralyzed from the neck down, the other a victim of multiple sclerosis, stage 4 cancer is reversed, and much more.
Let me pause you for a second, because what we're talking about, and then in a minute, I want to go to Gaza and Israel specifically, but what we're talking about is having an intention for seeds, an intention for peace, an intention for XYZ, whatever the intention is, actually has what you call a mirror effect on the participants that's completely different than what the intention is. It's kind of I'm going to call it the or something better. You're praying for peace over there, which is super important, but all of a sudden your cancer heals or you're out of the wheelchair.
Well, in those instances, those are cases of power of eight groups where people have gone into a small group and they have sometimes focused on that person, and that's happened. And sometimes that person was a sender focusing on somebody else. But you brought up a really important point, which is the mirror effect during intention experiments. Now, I've run, as I say, 40 of these, and now more. Those are 40 official intention experiments where we've measured outcomes. I've had scientists working on it, etc. We've had many more that have been more informal, but they are as important and as relevant and as, you know, as powerful as the more well-measured ones. For instance, the Israel and Gaza experiments we've been running. I haven't had a scientist measure it yet, but I might do because I want to see if our intention is increasing in potency. But as you say, what's been extraordinary is not just the effects on the target, that the effects on the participants has been a mirror effect. People intending for a peace intention experiment become more peaceful in their lives. They make up with estranged partners, children of theirs, grown children of theirs who haven't spoken to them for years, suddenly phone them after the experiment. They're getting along better with their bosses. They're getting along better with coworkers. And most of all, about 50% every single time tell me they're getting along better with strangers. They're getting along better with people who are not like them. They have more love for everyone they come in contact with. And it's over and over again. About a third of the people report healings. They say their asthma's better, or their hip doesn't hurt them anymore, or their blood sugar has gone down. We just have that with the peace intention experiment we've been doing for Gaza, and more and more and more. So what ends up happening is a fascinating ripple effect with these peace intention experiments. It's not simply the target that may have an effect, and we continue to hope it will, but it is the participants. And if you look at the numbers and what happens, everybody has a social network. They talk about not being triggered with people that are near and dear to them, or even their coworkers, being more accepting of things, being more tolerant of people not like them, people who have attitudes that are against everything they believe in, they're more tolerant of. So we've had about 30,000 of people who have participated in the ones I just started, the intention experiments. If each of them have 10 associates, then suddenly we are magnifying and magnifying and magnifying that effect out into the world. And that is one of the main things I now focus on. Not just the target, not just the action, but its reaction. And I'll tell you something else, Michael. I've been looking into why this has an effect.
Thank you.
Why do people get healed by just intending for something like this? So this was answered in the work of the University of California at Berkeley by a scientist, a psychologist called Dacher Keltner. And he did a study once with a graduate student where they took batches of students at Berkeley, divided them into two groups. One group was shown photos of the world's victims, like starving children. The other group were shown pictures of other students at Berkeley, of the campus itself, of them beating their football team at Berkeley, beating their closest rivals at Stanford. They were pictures designed to elicit pride in who they were. Then they showed them other photos. The people who had looked at the world's victims felt close to people not like them If they were Democrats, Republicans, the homeless, prisoners, their hearts had opened, whereas the other ones felt closer to doctors, lawyers, financiers, the people who they would become, the professionals they would become. They felt closer to people like them. And all of this has to do with, if you want a biological explanation, this all has to do with the vagus nerve. It's the longest nerve in the body. It starts at the neck. It has pit stops, makes pit stops on all the major organs of the body. And it controls our autonomic nervous system, like the sympathetic nervous system, when we go into fight or flight mode. But it also controls something else, our sense of connection and safety. And when we do intention, altruistic intention, and also if we do it en masse, particularly in a group, it activates and releases a hormone called oxytocin. Now, that is the love hormone. It gets released when we're in a loving relationship, we're having sex, when we're taking care of a baby of ours, it releases. And here's the thing. Oxytocin release makes us about 50% more trusting of people. Our hearts open. And so that's what we see when we do an intention for peace, which is an altruistic act. The heart leaps across the fence. We are able to connect with people not like us. So that is the real focus of my intentions these days, is getting those warring tribes, those polarities, to come back together.
Very cool. So if we take that to, you know, I wake up each day, Lynn, and I'm dumbfounded at the world today. I never thought we would be here. Carolyn Mace calls this the time of the unthinkable right now. I wake up and I look at this, whether it is the authoritarian grip taking place here in the U.S. or in other countries or Gaza and Israel, and I'm going, we are ascending, we are shifting. How are we making it through this time, though? What you're saying almost is, for some reason, there seems to be I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way, a drought or a shortage of oxytocin going on.
I love that. I think there is a drought of oxytocin. We've all retreated, if you want the biological explanation. We've all retreated into the very primitive part of the vagus nerve, which is fight or flight or freeze. And freeze is one of the big ones, where we retreat into our shells, where we refuse to engage with the other, and where we feel like we are, you know, we have to be right. We have to be right. I mean, I was fascinated the other day. We were flying back from Basel, Switzerland, in a great big event I was part of. And the woman sitting next to us, we just asked her to move because, you know, would you mind, could we get our overhead bags after we'd landed? And we were there 5 minutes and she just wasn't moving from her seat. And she was so appalled by that, by, I guess, being asked to do something she didn't agree with or something like that, that we saw her tell about four other people about it. Like, she really needed to demonize us because we had a different point of view than hers. And that, to me, pretty much typifies what's going on now. If we don't agree with someone, we have to tell the world about it. We have to demonize that person. We have to destroy them, essentially. So we've really retreated into a very primitive mode of being, I suppose, because we are all so terrified about this time of such uncertainty and turmoil and tumultuous happenings. But I think the great antidote to that, and this is what I see over and over again, is the power of small groups. one of the things that does heal trauma, one of the big things that heals trauma, and this was demonstrated too by research at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Barbara Fredrickson, showed that people can heal doing altruistic acts. They come together, they become more trusting, and also the power of small groups can heal even trauma. So that takes us to what human beings really need. One of the issues we have, the unthinkable, the biggest part of the unthinkable is that we're so isolated. You know, we always lived in community. We were so isolated during COVID that I think it's about 1 in 5 people got traumatized by that. The fact that they couldn't connect with their loved ones. They couldn't see their parents or grandchildren or friends. You know, that was one of the cruelest things that could happen. And it's so difficult for the human species to live in isolation. It's the one thing that people cannot bear. You know, indigenous cultures, cultures of the past too, if they wanted to really punish somebody, they banished them. You know, they ostracized them. And it is one of the cruelest things you can do to a human. People commit suicide often, as psychologists put it, because of they feel excessive individuation, meaning in normal speak, they feel left out. So we need to connect, and connection and community heals us from and prevents everything from heart attacks, stroke, even the common cold. So what I'm interested in now in these times is the healing power of small community. And by that, I mean a power of a group.
Thank you. It seems like I think we can take this on a scientific rather than a woo-woo-ific perspective. But it seems like we are energy having an energetic experience in human form, purporting to be human, thinking we're human, appearing to be human. But we're an energetic wave or frequency. We come into existence, we flicker out of existence. Maybe we do so more slowly than a quantum particle, but it's the same rules apply, maybe at a different scale of time. However, when you bring that power of eight together, what I see is this lattice work structure, this, we're going to call it web of energy, and we are plugging in to that field at that level of love, of altruism, of healing, and we start to get in resonance. Sort of like you put one cuckoo clock in a room, all of a sudden every clock is, you get in resonance with that, and then all sorts of magic takes place because of that frequency that you are now vibrating at.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, first of all, we are resonating in unison, no question. Even when two guitarists start playing a few notes together, their brain waves start operating in sync. When people are thinking the same thought together, their brains start operating in sync. And I think there's so many reasons why power of eight groups work. And as I said, I've seen thousands of people get healed. One of my favorites of recent times is Esther. Yeah. Esther and her her son, Stefan, are from Switzerland, and they decided to come to a retreat of mine. And so we hold these retreats in a beautiful stately home in the north of England where I live. I live in London. And we had this retreat, and it's about healing your past. Part of this is putting people from the get-go into Power of Eight groups. So we did. Now, Esther wasn't going to come because after she and her son decided to come, she was diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma. Doctors said, you've got about 3 months to live. So she didn't think she was going to be able to make it. She was losing energy, all of that. They talked to our team. We suggested they come because if nothing else, Esther would have a lovely last experience of loving groups, etc. They came. Poor Stefan had a virus through the whole thing. But the first night he was there and witnessed this, Esther was with her group, the newly formed Power of Eight group, and they met in the library of this 16th century stately home where we hold this. They held a Power of Eight intention for her healing. It was so far and deep, and only 10 minutes, by the way. And that's all I ever say, 10 minutes. That's all you need. So far and deep. Everybody felt it. Everybody was transported. At the end of it, she said, "I am healed." Now, everybody thought that was wishful thinking. She goes home. She follows a good diet. She was a naturopathic physician, but no chemo, no radiation. A few months later, her doctors are astounded to discover when they next do a scan on her, no cancer left, absolutely gone. And she credits that one Power of Eight group session with healing her life. Last weekend, I had a woman whose vocal cords were frozen. She hadn't been able to speak for some years. We did an intention on her, and this was just one group of many in this big, big event. There were 8,500 people at this event, but this particular workshop of mine had about 1,500. They did an intention for her, and she started talking afterwards. She told me the whole story. It was quite amazing. So I see miracles all the time. I see miracles beyond the point where I call them miracles anymore. I just see them as the inevitable result of the capacity we have when we get together with an altruistic intention.
Thank you. We're going to be diving into an intention. We're going to do our own intention experiment, we'll say, toward the end, and we're going to take 10 minutes on this. Is the reverse? I'm looking at the world today, which is... an interesting place, to say the least. Do you believe the reverse is taking place, that so many people are focused on, let us say, a negative outcome or a fearful outcome, that we are generating things in that direction until we stop and make a conscious intention to go in another direction? Because there's almost a group think or a group prayer going on when you watch the news and go, "Oh my God."
I think there's an element of that, Michael, of people going, "Ain't it awful?" And, you know, that taking hold and people being fearful and negative, pessimistic, distrustful, all of those things are going to affect people and what they're sending out to the world. Remember, I like to call us leaky buckets because we don't hold thoughts inside our heads. Thoughts are broadcast. We are trespassers. We're sending out thoughts and getting other people's thoughts back and forth. And we know now that thoughts are not locked inside our heads. So yes, that's going on. I think there's a lot more going on too. There is a lot of a loss of free speech, a huge loss of free speech. A controlling of the narrative, the controlling of the media. We certainly saw that over COVID. You know, we saw a controlling of the media. I've never been so ashamed to be a journalist. I thought, where are the journalists now? How come nobody is questioning anything? You know, that's the job of a journalist. You're not supposed to be a mouthpiece of the government. You're supposed to be holding the government's foot to the fire. That's your job.
What do you think is going on there? Because I watch, that's one of the big pieces that, so I have several different degrees, not touting myself, but one of those degrees is in political science in world affairs. And I see such a, I will watch the news from one country and it'll be, I don't even know how to put it. There is such a bias in the media going on. There is such an internal censorship by the journalists themselves going on. There is such a controlling of the narrative. And I can't believe, dare I say, heading back toward World War II, authoritarian push going on that is not being covered by the media in general. In general, what do you think is going on?
Well, I think what's going on is money. To be honest, money and corruption more than anything else. I am not one of those believers, or I certainly don't have enough evidence to demonstrate one big vast conspiracy is going on to, take over the world. It's not a vast conspiracy and it's not secret. What's happening is the control of many things are being controlled by very wealthy individuals who, like somebody like a Bill Gates, who's now owns a lot of media. You know, a lot of billionaires own a lot of the media, and a lot of the media is suffering because people, for instance, aren't buying newspapers so much anymore. So they have certain advertising they have to, that keeps them from going out of business. A lot of that advertising is pharmaceutical stuff. And so they're certainly not going to criticize anything related to drugs or COVID or anything like that. They're going to go with the narrative. But also there are bigger fish that own these things now. And so the independent voice in media is gone. I mean, we saw that during COVID, just looking at the other side of my work as editor and co-editor of a magazine called What Doctors Don't Tell You. My husband and I started this, as I mentioned, 33 years ago. And we are an independent voice that looks at conventional and alternative medicine. And we are very evidence-based. And we, you know, we followed COVID during that whole thing and we called everything right. We stuck with the science. We looked at, you know, what was really happening. And we looked at the doctors who were being shut down. And all of the voices that had been silenced that were, you know, the scientific studies that were coming to light that would be shut down, all of that we reported on. And we found that we were about the only voice other than a few out there who were telling this story. Everybody else was either towing the line of the government or, you know, talking about vast conspiracies. So we were following the science actually, and the science was frightening, but it was being covered up.
It's fascinating because we will be on Rumble and YouTube and Facebook and potentially Instagram as well for this show. And if I, as we're going down this topic, if I'm not careful where we thread that needle, the show actually literally gets yanked.
Yep.
That's the world we're living in today. Isn't that crazy?
It is. It is. And that also is another part of the censorship. Absolutely. And, you know, we should move on to another topic as a result.
let's do that. Well, let's bring it back to the light.
Yeah, we talked about what's going on now. And what's going on now is, I guess, to put it, to summarize it, we've got to the point in our scientific story of this belief in competitive individualism where we are about to eat our own children. In fact, we are eating our own children. It is blowing itself up, capitalism. And so this is not to argue against capitalism. I don't believe in, you know, in super socialism. It's never worked anywhere. But I believe in something a bit kinder and far more open than we've got now. So I think that is that rampant capitalism, uber capitalism we have now is destroying our world and destroying our countries.
Can we, thank you, and I couldn't agree more. Can we, though, look at this? Like, I'm looking at the horrors going on in Gaza right now. And I'm sending as much love and light and positive attention. And I'm going, I'm hopeful. This is a really terrible thing to say. I don't know a better way to put it. I'm hopeful that what I'm witnessing is, it stops this nanosecond stops, but that it has been so shocking that people will go, like right after 9/11, everybody went to love. They went to war later. They went to love right away. Everybody came together. That people actually come together after this.
I think so. And I, you know, I hope for too. I'm very hopeful that, you know, we're taking this, our intention in baby steps. So we've done, you know, ceasefire, et cetera. I oftentimes find when more work is needed, break it down. So first, we're now intending for the hostages to be released, for there to be food supplies and electricity in Gaza, for a safe passage for the Gazan citizens out, for all of and an immediate end to, you know, the killings of civilians. So we're focusing on that, and we'll keep focusing on one other step at a time. And as you say, I'm hopeful that it was so extreme, so shocking, that it finally brings different countries together to say, let's solve this once and for all. Let's just stop this. This is insane. And it needs a consortium of Arab nations, Israel, other Western nations, to come together and say, let's do this, because it was a big, messy mistake to in how it was handled. In 1948, it was, you know, the UN and other countries created this mess where everybody was right and everybody was wrong. And they need to bring both sides together to start creating a lasting peace where this never, ever happens again.
Thank you. And that really brings us right back to Power at 8 and intention. What we're talking is bringing people together.
Absolutely. And as I said, my key focus now is healing people in their lives. You know, people are suffering in every regard. Terrible health issues, terrible financial issues, terrible relationship issues, terrible careers, you know, humdrum, boring, unfulfilling careers. And even many, many people who come to take my courses, who want the next act. They want a better life purpose than they have now. They need a noble pursuit, as Aristotle says. Yes. And so all of those are wonderful reasons for creating a Power of Eight group. And it's much of what I teach in my Power of Eight Intention Masterclass, which is just kicking off now. We just opened the doors. Once a year, I hold this course where I teach people live and interactive on Zoom, but then we put them in groups, and I love the Beatles. So we name the groups after Beatles songs.
Have you heard? I haven't heard the new song yet. Have you heard the new song?
Yes, now and then. It's lovely. It's lovely. Yeah. And it's wistful. It's great. It's wistful. You know, it's John thinking back over the times. It's a nice one to end them with, because there was so much rancor at the time.
Yes.
So we put people into groups. We call them at Beatles songs. And I work for them for a whole year. Because one thing I started to notice is, yes, you can work with people for 10 minutes. That's all it takes, 10 minutes. I've seen people, 8 minutes, that woman regained her voice. It wasn't even 10 minutes. It doesn't take hours of priming and all of those things. It takes 10 minutes to get into this altered state, and I'll explain why in a moment. One thing I noticed is, yes, that's true. But if I put them in groups for a whole year, I wondered, would everything in their life begin to heal? And the answer for a real majority of people is yes. You know, we've had people like Mitchell Dean, who was suffering from suicidal depression. And not only did he heal that in his group, but his practice, he is a clinical psychologist. So being depressed was not a good look for him. But we healed not only his health, but also his practice got better. His Qigong practice got better. He somehow lost 15 pounds, even though he was only working out once a week. His trainer was stunned by this, and he overcame writer's block. Everything. Oh, and he also started playing music again. So everything in his life began to heal. And that's what I look for, too. But there's also another thing that's going on here, Michael, which is the love of the group. One of the guys who was in one of my master classes during COVID, the end of COVID, it's a guy called Jerry. And he said at the end of it, he wanted to take the course again and have another group. He wanted more. And I said, why, Jerry? He said, I have felt more love from my group and compassion than I have ever felt in my life. And at the end of the second year, he said, I now know what love is. And I think if you have a group of strangers, because that's what they start out with, who have your back, who are sending in loving intention to you, and they're doing it for everybody in the group week after week after week, that is extraordinarily strengthening. That is extraordinarily healing.
And that, I think, is one of, we have our school of mystics. That is one of the positives, I'll say, of coming out of this time of isolationism is we've all become Zoomers. We all now have that opportunity to find our tribe, to find our family, where we're not weirdos, we're not strangers, we're understood. And we come together, to, like you're saying, with a loving intention.
Absolutely. It's so important. Now, I promised I would tell you why this works so quickly.
Yeah.
You don't need priming. You don't need an hour of heavy meditation to get into it, or to start chanting like a Sufi master or whatever. Several years ago, I worked with a team of neuroscientists at Life University, which is one of the largest chiropractic universities in the world. The team was put at my disposal. So we gathered together 7 Power of 8 groups of student volunteers. These were people who had never meditated before, had never done Power of 8 groups. And we put them into groups and we put an EEG cap on one member of each group who was doing the sending. They did intention for one member of the group with some sort of health challenge. And while they did that, the scientists measured what was going on in their brainwaves. And they found, to our astonishment, that the brain waves look nothing like they do during meditation, which creates an increase of alpha waves, slower waves than ordinary waking consciousness, or gamma, very, very quick waves when you are a real experienced meditator. That happens sometimes. There was no increase in brain waves. There was a decrease, a massive decrease in brain waves. They were turning off. Particularly the parts of the brain like that sit right here, the parietal lobes that help us navigate through space, they were dialed down. And so were the parts of the brain, the right frontal lobes involved with worry, doubt, negativity. They were also dialed way down. So these were people in a state of ecstatic oneness. Their brainwave signatures were almost identical to those recorded by Dr. Andrew Newberg at the University of Pennsylvania at the time.
We interviewed Dr. Andrew Newberg for our book on automatic writing because it takes you into that same brainwave state. Parietal, which is I'm going to call it the George Harrison of the Beatles, the I, me, my part of the brain gets knocked offline. And the frontal lobe, what do I need to do? Where do I need to go? Any of that powers down as well.
Absolutely. And that is exactly what was going on. And it is what happens when Buddhist monks are involved in ecstatic prayer and Sufi masters during chanting. So these are, I love that, the I, me, mine. That's so Beatlesque. I love it. I, me, mine, part of the brain, Michael, because that was exactly it. That part is turned off. So these are people experiencing oneness. And we don't get to experience that. You know, we experience life in separation. You know, people always say to me, well, how do I enter the field? And I say, you don't need a door. You are the field. You know, you're here. You're already in the field, but you don't experience life like that. We experience life as being separate, lonely little people in a lonely little universe. But when we do Power of 8 groups, we experience oneness, and people describe, so do people in my intention experiments, very quickly describe altered states of consciousness. They talk about, you know, feeling goosebumps up and down their arms, feeling heavy amounts of energy, heat. They cry uncontrollably. This is thousands of people reporting this over and over and over again. And so they're experiencing this state of oneness, an altered state. But let's go back to our student volunteers. Remember, these are people who had never even meditated before. Nevertheless, within a minute, they were not even a minute, they were transported into the miraculous. So I always say, you know, you don't need drugs. You don't need years of priming or years of, you know, of study. You don't need hours of priming to get into a state, even an hour of priming. All you need is a group and a common intention, and it's a fast track to the miraculous.
Where does time fit into this? If you do an experiment and it's recorded and someone watches it later, we all know time is not real. Will it have the same effect?
It can do. Now, that's a very interesting thing, because what we do in retreats is we do Heal Your Past retreats, which were all about using retro intention. And the results we get are
Tell me more.
Well, as you said, Michael, time doesn't exist. Every good physicist these days, worth his salt, will say there's no such thing as linear time. Carlo Rovelli basically said time doesn't exist. Many, many studies, and I detailed them in my book, The Intention Experiment, show that time doesn't exist. Some of my favorites were the remote viewing studies done by the pair researchers at Princeton University, the PAIR program, where they would have teams of people. One is the remote viewer who would stay in the lab, and the traveling partner would be randomly handed an envelope, which would contain a destination he would have to go to, she would have to go to. Now, they did loads of experiments doing that, where the traveling partner would go someplace and the remote viewer wouldn't know where it was, but would have to draw and describe where his person was. But then they started doing precognitive stuff, where they had the remote viewer draw and describe where his partner was going before the partner even knew where he was going, before he'd even taken the envelope. And they had breathtaking results. Two-thirds to three-quarters of all of the remote viewing was accurate, hugely accurate, where they were describing exactly where they were. One time he described a building. One remote viewer described that his partner was in a building with all kinds of turrets and doorways that had a point above them, and described it beautifully. And it turned out to be a gallery in Moscow, and it looked exactly as he described. Somebody else described a train station, and it turned out that the partner was going to a train station in Glencoe, Illinois. I mean, he even described the posters on the walls, everything. And this was precognitive. This was before the guy had even taken the envelope. So there is so much evidence for that, and also retro intention too. Huge amounts of evidence. So what I do, and I work with my husband, Brian Hubbard, who is the author of a book called The Untrue Story of You, who has developed a thing called time light. And it is the fact that time essentially, according to Brian, is an energy. And it essentially something that has happened in the past essentially sits inside you like an unwanted guest. And that energy creates the patterns, the bad patterns we all have. So I use a lot of retro intention to go back to that time, not to change what happened. You don't imagine a different outcome. What you do is take back your power. And that is the important thing. You take back your energy, because your energy, your power has been stolen from you when you have a situation where you are traumatized in some way, even if it's just being humiliated at school. That can stay with you and affect you forever and be responsible for a lot of your bad choices in life. So we do a lot of that. So time, getting back to your question, no, time doesn't matter. So many studies, Helmut Schmidt did very early REG experiments where he would run the programs, hide them away, and then have someone intend for it. And as long as it hadn't been thought about or intended for before that, he found that the thing had an effect. So even if it was in a, he would have a control tape too, and he would show the control tape wouldn't have any change, but the one intended for would. And Robert John and Brenda Dunn at the Pear Research Lab did the same in Princeton. They would do intentions after machines had run, and they found that they had an effect. So there were all kinds of experiments like this. They've had experiments out of time for people editing their own breathing. One ingenious batch of experiments had to do with traffic in Vienna and foot passengers in Vienna, and found retro-intention effects. Dean Radin looked at this whole process once, and he looked at it. Yeah, he's great, isn't he? They looked at this whole process through a two-step psychological study. He did about 5,000 of these, and he found, are you ready for this? The time it took to do the second part of the experiment influenced the time it took to do the first part. I'll say that again. The time it took to carry out the second step influenced the time it took to carry out the first. So his conclusion, and the conclusion of many people, including the late Robert John and so many of the giants in this field, is we have to take time out of it, and it all makes sense, as John once said to me, because I said, how can this all be, early on in my research? Dean decided, we don't change the past. The future changes the present as it unfolds. The future changes the present as it unfolds. Mind-boggling, eh?
So where does intention, because therefore your intention of the future will therefore ripple back in the pond to where you're at right now?
I guess so. Yeah. We have to stop thinking of life as linear time. This does not mean that we live in a totally deterministic universe. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that time is one big smeared out now. And so if you think of it that way, you think of intention rippling back and forward in what we call time.
We just did in our School of Mystics a clearing last night where we went back to old traumas from people. And what I help people do is I call it removing sticky energy. And you can actually remove the energy of that, and it has a ripple effect. All of a sudden, things are radically different by expunging that one thing. Since time's not real, it's now we're taking care of it, not then, but it's then we're taking care of it, rippling all the way forward.
Absolutely. This is the amazing thing of it. Because it is energy, because we are energy, because these events are energy, you can change that energy, and it affects everything else. Because we are energetic beings. Of course it's going to affect us.
Which means, and then I want to get into, well, I want to know about the masterclass, and then let's dive into an intention meditation here.
Okay, great.
It means, going back real briefly to what we were touching on earlier, we'll call them oligarchs, we'll call them powers that be. This is such a, it's a dangerous word to use, a democratic power. When we understand that we are energy, when we understand that we use energy, can play with energy, can create with energy, we're no longer stoppable. We're no longer stuck in anybody else's paradigm.
Yes.
Which means it's both information that gets to get out, and it's information that's had a hard time getting out.
Well, we all have to be Jedi Knights now. And we all have to wake up. So use whichever movie you want, whether it is Matrix or it is Star Wars. But we all have to wake up and recognize what is happening and essentially question the narratives that we're being told, and also know that the power we do hold to together collectively. It's massive. It is massive. It always has been massive. But yes, absolutely. And it can just be the power of our thoughts, which no one can police.
There's some interesting books on that one. But yes, I completely agree. The big challenge there, without going down the rabbit hole, is how much the narrative is controlled and how much we may buy into it until we do things like this, which I'm convinced then set us free. We're going to call it a reset button back to the true energy of who and what we are.
Absolutely. I mean, we do have to wake up. We do have to recognize how manipulated we are by the media, et cetera, that we have to distrust a lot of what we read and, you know, discern these things for ourselves. We have to think a little differently, and we have to gather with people who also believe that in the power of thoughts, the power of us together and what we can maintain and create together. And we have to be optimistic.
Hugely important. On that note, where can people go to find your masterclass? What can you tell us about that? Where can people go to find out more? And we're going to do a peace intention meditation here in a minute, but where can people go to find all of your peace intention experiments?
Okay. If they go to lynnmctaggart.com, first of all, my Power of Eight Intention Masterclass, which kicks off February 17th. We've just opened the doors to it. It's a year-long course. And what we do in that is I teach live and interactive for 2 hours on six successive Saturdays, starting in February. And I teach the 13 keys to intention mastery. I show you how to use intention in relationships, which is so important. I teach you how to overcome negativity, how to pick up other people's intentions, how to stop self-sabotaging, using it in relationships. So powerful now. And of course, all of the rudimentaries of running a Power of Eight group. And it's, believe me, a lot of people get a lot of that wrong. So they can find it on my website, lynnmctaggart.com. And they can also, by signing up, you get information about the peace intention experiments I'm running, the Israeli-Palestinian ones in particular right now. And it's always free. Intention experiments are always free. I will never charge for them. And you will meet other people on these intentions. We've run thousands of them, where they are discovering the rebound power, the extraordinary power, mirror effect of doing intention, an altruistic act like that, and how it ripples into their own lives.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. We're going to go into a peace intention experiment here for Gaza and for Israel, or meditation at least for Gaza and for Israel in just a moment. But you had said something that I picked up on. You'd said a lot of people get that wrong. Do you recall what that was you were saying?
Absolutely. A lot of people get a lot of the 13 keys to intention mastery wrong. They believe they have to embellish it with, you know, white lights and purple flames and all of that. But they also get wrong the phrasing of intentions. Most people think you should leave it up to the universe. In our experience, particularly with the intention experiments, we need the reverse. We need to be highly specific. When we sent love to water, nothing happened. When we said to the water, we'd like to move you by one full pH to become more alkaline, therefore more pure, it worked. So we found, and we found that in individuals' lives, it's important to be specific. Tell the universe what you want. So that's part of the training, is to show what specific means. It doesn't mean a page-long intention, but it does mean letting the universe know. You know, if you want to heal Jane Doe's right toe, you say so. You say so, and everybody holds it together.
Thank you. A last note, and let's dive into a meditation. There are those teachers who say, but if you do that, you entrain the exact opposite of what you want, but you're finding the exact reverse. You know, people say, well, if I intend for a change in income for anything, then I'm anchoring in that I don't have. That's not how it works, is it?
No, not at all. And oftentimes people will say things like, I want to be rich. And when they don't mean that, they mean, I want more time, or I want anything but this job. So I figure if I'm rich, I'll be great. I won't have to do this job. Or I want, you know, I need $2,531, but I figure if I ask for the lottery win, then I'll have much more than that. Well, I usually tell them, ask the universe what you need. And invariably, people on my course will get these windfalls that are about exactly what they need. They're really quite extraordinary. So I have found over and over again, letting the universe know what you want is really important. If you don't, if you just say, okay, you decide, universe, that's very close to prayer. That's like, okay, God, you decide, thy will be done, you know, and that is prayer. This is different. It's a respectful request to the universe.
Thank you. Can we then make a 10-minute respectful request to the universe? I'm guessing, since we're doing baby steps here, what a huge baby step. Is it ceasefire? Is it safe passage? What do we want to do today?
Okay. We can start. We want to free all of the hostages without harm. We want safe corridor for all Gazan civilians. We want electricity and water and aid to be immediately available, and there to be an end of killings of all civilians. So we're taking that intermediate step, and we'll work toward ceasefire.
Sounds great. I leave it in your capable hands.
Okay, everybody. I want everybody listening to take a deep inhale and a deep exhale. A deep inhale and a deep exhale. A deep inhale, a deep exhale. And now, on the inhalation, I want you to imagine you're holding hands with all of the thousands of people watching this. And imagine we're all in the same room together. Let's take one more deep inhale, one more deep exhale. And now let's hold the following intention. Our intention is that all hostages be immediately released without harm, that safe corridor for all Gazan civilians be immediately open, that aid, electricity, and water be immediately available to Gazans, and that there be an immediate end to killings of all civilians. Let's hold that intention. And we're going to hold it for about 10 minutes. As we do, take this down to your heart. Send it out through your heart. And when you do, I want you to imagine with your five senses. See it, hear it, smell it, taste it, feel it. The hostages being freed. The safe corridor being established. The aid getting through, the end to the killings. Imagine that in detail with your mind as you hold that intention. Let's hold it together, feeling the energy. So hold it, and as you do, feel as well what's going on in your body. Are you feeling energy? Are you getting emotional? Feel that too. Feel the power and the energy of all of the people on this call, united, connected. Also, take note of what you visualize and just keep imagining it with all of your senses as we hold this together. okay. Let go of that intention now. Trust the process. In your own time, come back onto this broadcast. And in your own time, over the coming days and weeks, notice the peace in your own life. And if anything has changed in your relationships, in your outlook, and in your health.
Thank you so much, Lynn. That was beautiful. One quick question on it, then we'll wrap this up. I guess two last things. If people's minds go astray, is there something, some tool they can use to keep bringing them back to the intention and bring them back to the intention?
Just keep imagining. It's okay for your mind to wander to visualizations of the outcome. As I mentioned, just go back and imagine peace. Imagine that corridor for the Gazans. Imagine the hostages being freed and their loved ones hugging them and rejoicing. Imagine all of those things. Imagine an end to the killings. And that will be your anchor.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Any last words you want to share with people, Lynn? And this has been stunning, beautiful, awesome, amazing, incredible. I'm loving it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. My last comments really are, you have power inside yourself. You have power in groups. So never feel powerless, no matter what is going on in the world. Find yourself a group. Find your power in numbers. And understand that you can heal yourself, each other, and the world.
Woohoo! Thank you so much, Lynn. So for everyone out there, this is Michael Sandler saying, be well, have fun, get in the power of a group and broadcast your power and discover it to the world. And above and beyond all else, shine bright.
So now the question arises, is what Lynn McTaggart and the other people are associated around the world do at that time affect what's happening now? Because the borders are open, some of the hostages are being released, and then there's talk of extending it even further. Aid's going into Gaza. Who knows? But I'm a great believer in the power of positive thinking and the collective consciousness. Another guy of the same opinion is Kulam. Now, he's an Israeli singer who in 2018 brought together 3,000 people in Haifa in Israel. There were Jews, Arabs, Pakeha, everybody, all collected together. And they all sang together this song that he wrote, which is called One Day, which was a belief and hope that one day is the Israel-Palestinian thing sorted out. It's in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. I am Barry. It's been the Voice Within. Kakite, Shalom, Namaste, Masalam. May your God go with you.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.